From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away. I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, we saw a dramatic CBS exclusive unravel.
We end our broadcast tonight with a correction on a story we reported October 27th about the attack on the American Special Mission compound in Benghazi, in which Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans were killed.
That's correspondent Lara Logan. On October 27th, 60 Minutes aired her interview with security contractor Dylan Davies, using the pseudonym Morgan Jones, who was in Libya during last September's assault on the diplomatic compound in Benghazi. What is no longer in doubt is that the Benghazi episode was a coordinated attack by Islamic militants on the anniversary of 9/11. It was not, as President Obama first seemed to characterize it, a spontaneous protest over an inflammatory anti-Muslim video that had recently surfaced. The attack also laid bare a series of management and leadership failures at the State Department, but no internal investigation, congressional inquiry, or journalistic enterprise has located anything more sinister. Still, for the past year, Benghazi has been used as a political bludgeon by conservative media and House Republicans who have convened hearings, attacked administration figures, and entertained elaborate conspiracy theories, mostly alleging a politically motivated cover-up by a president seeking re-election. The GOP-fanned smoke had yielded no actual fire and had largely dissipated when Davies showed up on 60 Minutes. He recounted his heroics amid the chaos and lack of trained guards at the compound, an account which impeached the administration's version of events.
Morgan Jones scaled the 12-foot-high wall of the compound that was still overrun with Al-Qaeda fighters.
One guy saw me. He just shouted. I couldn't believe that he'd seen me because it was so dark. He started walking towards me.
And as he was coming closer?
As I got closer, I just hit him with the butt of the rifle in the face.
And?
Oh, he went down, yeah, like a stone.
And no one saw you do it?
No.
Or heard it?
No. There was too much noise.
Pretty hair-raising, but as it turns out, Davies got nowhere near the embassy that night. His personal heroics were an invention, along with the rest of his story. Shortly after the report aired, the Washington Post reported that Davies' employer denied his presence at the compound. Then the New York Times spoke to the FBI, which also said Davies was elsewhere that night. All the while, liberal media monitoring group Media Matters hammered at CBS for answers. The network had a lot of splaining to do. Once again, Lara Logan.
The most important thing to every person at 60 Minutes is the truth. And the truth is, we made a mistake.
Fair enough, but if truth is important to CBS, how could it have aired such politically explosive allegations without corroboration by a man about to release a book about Benghazi? Why did CBS producers not ask themselves the cardinal question, who benefits?
All you know from the correction is, we did something wrong, we made a mistake, we're not going to tell you anything more about it.
That's Tom Rosenstiel of the American Press Institute on NewsHour this week.
They didn't make clear in that correction what they had done that created a misimpression, what information he'd conveyed that confused people or fed conservative critics of this.
The media-watching universe was uniformly dissatisfied with CBS's correction. Press critic Jay Rosen wryly called it minimalist. Apologies are nice, but the blogosphere demanded truth and reconciliation, and in its absence commenced to filling in the blanks. For instance, could it be that the who benefits question has an uncomfortable answer? Davies' book was to have been published by Simon & Schuster, a subsidiary of, what do you know, CBS. Tom Rosenstiel.
You don't know what pressures are inside a company when one side of the company is publishing the book. You've got to be extra vigilant under those circumstances so you don't put yourself in this kind of situation. Well, explain.
Weirdly, CBS News has been down this path before. Back in 2004, Dan Rather fronted an investigative piece that apparently documented young George W. Bush's avoidance of Vietnam-era military duty in the Texas Air National Guard. In that case, there were multiple sources, But the most prominent among them was a set of documents presented as Exhibit A, documents that turned out most likely to have been forged. When their veracity was questioned, CBS News dug in its heels. Only after weeks of unanswered questions did Rather and company acknowledge that they didn't have the goods. His mea culpa sounded like this.
Also, I want to say personally and directly, I'm sorry.
Heads rolled, including Rather's. This after the network brought in an independent panel headed by former Attorney General Dick Thornburgh to document the producers' series of journalistic failures, some of incompetence, some of dishonesty. It makes instructive reading to this day, The Anatomy of a Fail. CBS News released a statement on Wednesday promising a, quote, journalistic review, but neglected to comment on what form that might take. These exercises aren't merely academic, and they aren't merely crisis PR management. In her most recent column, New York Times public editor Margaret Sullivan demonstrated the toll of insufficient altruspection. She took it upon herself to do what editorial management never had, reconstructing the paper's 2004 decision to withhold for 13 months James Risen's and Eric Lichtblau's scoop about warrantless wiretapping by the Bush administration. Apart from the civic consequences of leaving a nation in the dark, that hesitation came to affect the Times' own news gathering. Leaker Edward Snowden said that the Times' decision led him this summer to bestow his explosive NSA snooping revelations on Glenn Greenwald and The Guardian instead of The New York Times. That decision is one the Times may well think about the next time around, because in order to learn from our mistakes, we must first have the courage to say them out loud. This week saw a sharp spike in speculation for who will be president in 2017. Reminder, it's been about 10 months since President Obama was sworn into office, which means the next inaugural is a mere 38 months away.
This is going to be fantastic. Add this to the list, Ted Cruz to the list of Republicans who may be considering running for president in 2016. The freshman
Hillary Clinton continues to dominate the 2016 presidential speculation.
Thank you.
But there's an unapologetic liberal who could stir things up. First-term Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Well, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie won re-election by a landslide this week, making him the early front-runner for the Republican presidential nomination in 2016.
Mark Leibovich, in an upcoming piece in the New York Times Magazine, writes, NBC has Hillary up 44-34 over Chris Christie in a hypothetical 2016 general election poll from November. The hypothetical debates will be crucial, too, as well any hypothetical gaffes, ads, and the campaign's hypothetical get-out-the-hypothetical-vote operations. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Great to hypothetically be here, Bob.
Hey, you know how irritating it is when the Christmas decorations go up at the mall before your own jack-o'-lantern goes soft? You see where I'm going with this?
I do. I think you're talking about wildly premature speculation, and one of the political maxims is that no one tunes into the general election until the World Series. The change now is that the World Series has occurred 3 years before the actual election rather than 3 weeks before the actual election.
There have been a lot of data points. I mean, if you can call that data, something from the left-leaning public policy polling last week had Hillary Clinton leading Senator Ted Cruz from Texas by 17 points. Now, Hillary Clinton hasn't declared for anything. Cruz certainly hasn't declared. Yet the pollsters declared it has the potential of producing the most lopsided national vote since Lyndon Johnson trounced Barry Goldwater in 1964. Well, you got to hand it to them. They're swinging for the fences. Not only do they have hypothetical candidates, they've got a hypothetical landslide.
Yeah, no, they do. And I think if you look at the hypothetical field operation in hypothetical Ohio in 2016, you look at a distinct advantage for the Democrats. Now, I think what we're doing here, Bob, with our constant percussive use of the word hypothetical, is really pounding home the utter absurdity of this. This is yet another chapter in the continuum of speculation, punditry replacing reporting as the gold standard in our industry.
We're treating it as an absurdity. And yet the New Republic, apparently in dead earnest, did a piece about first-term Senator Elizabeth Warren titled Hillary's Nightmare. How do serious-minded people justify this out-of-control speculation?
One of the funny things about this is that the politicians themselves are playing to this hypothetical environment. I think any serious person or observer of politics would say that Chris Christie is thinking very seriously about running for president and doing the things that you do and talking to the people that you talk to and putting organizations in place. And then if you were to actually ask him about it, he would probably say something like, well, I don't answer hypothetical questions. They operate in a hypothetical landscape, and then they just stand above it, shrouding themselves in this very hypothetical-ism that they are partaking of.
A lot can happen in 3 years, including Elizabeth Warren and Chris Christie being hit by trucks, including war, including scandal, including sickness, including the rise of some hitherto unknown. At some point, doesn't it go beyond silly to actual malpractice?
If you were to define irresponsible or malpractice by creating an utter waste of time for your viewers and readers and listeners and what have you, then yes, you have it. Now, the American people and the American media have a right to complete and utter wastes of time. I, for instance, just spent the last 20 minutes on Twitter. I don't think it's malpractice in that anyone is being smeared. I think it's malpractice in that, you know, you're certainly not creating a smarter electorate. You're creating an electorate that is even more grounded in the purely parlor gaming, hypothetical, you know, world that politics exists in.
Which becomes, does it not, infotainment and something other than actual journalism?
Yes, although I would argue that there is no info behind it and there is no tainment behind it. I mean, there are some truths embedded in it and certainly some possibilities embedded in it that could very well come to pass. But I think as of right now, our time would be better spent, watching Cars Rust or something.
Let he who was without sin cast the first stone. And in this case, he means the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, where you hang your hat. Yep. The Times has itself played this little parlor game already, has it not?
We are guilty. We are not above this. I'd like to think that we do it less often and maybe in a more considered way. But when you hang around in Washington and when you deal in the political class, as I do as a political reporter, much of your time and much of the conversation is given over to the noise, which is exactly what this is. Which is not to say that such noise will not exist at an even more intense level in a few years. But when you're 3 years out and you have to caveat everything with, granted, a lot could change, you are just giving a signal to everyone that this could be a massive waste of time.
Okay, now, of course, I'm obliged to ask, when do you start doing your speculating?
You know what, Bob? With all due respect, I don't answer hypothetical questions.
Mark, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate it.
Mark Leibovich is the national political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine and author of This Town, Two Parties, A Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. Coming up, what do you call a posse of Texans armed to the teeth with shotguns and assault rifles? How about free speech? This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from The New School, offering graduate programs in media studies and media management. These flexible cross-disciplinary programs are designed to carefully balance theory and practice so students are fully engaged with current media scholarship, as well as the latest tools of media production and management. The programs can be completed on campus in New York City, online, or in a combination of on-campus and online study. More information about the New School's graduate programs in Media Studies and Media Management is available at newschool.edu/media NYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Last weekend, a small group of women met at the Blue Mesa Grill in the Dallas suburb of Arlington. The women belonged to the local chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, a gun control advocacy group formed after the mass shooting at Connecticut's Sandy Hook Elementary. At the same time that Moms Demand Action was holding its meeting, a larger group of men, women, and children rallied outside the restaurant, protesting the moms by defiantly carrying the very weapons at issue. That group was Open Carry Texas, whose principal means of expression is to rally in force fully armed. The question is, in a society that considers cross-burning and flag-burning and political donations protected speech, can a posse bearing lethal weapons make the same claim? Slate's Dahlia Lithwick wrote this week about the rise of open carry demonstrations. Dahlia, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you for having me.
In Texas, openly carrying rifles, even assault rifles, is perfectly legal, right? Provided there's no intent to threaten or frighten or intimidate.
The open carry law is clear, and Texas is by no means the only open carry state. And you are allowed to carry long guns, which includes the kind of shotguns, rifles, AR-15s, AK-47s that were being brandished in the parking lot. That very, very strange provision about whether it's, quote, calculated to alarm is the ambiguous part here, because who knows what's calculated to alarm. And here's where Open Carry Texas is really interesting. They say the purpose here is not intimidation. They say our objective is to educate. We are only knowing and intentionally engaging in content meant to raise awareness. So this is the opposite of trying to create alarm. What we're trying to do is create a dialogue, a conversation about the Second Amendment, and what is more speechy than that.
And to create a new normal wherein the very sight of people with loaded guns simply isn't scary. It's just the status quo.
Well, that's, you know, a big part of these open carry protests. If people can just get accustomed to seeing American guys out of uniform walking around with AK-47s strapped to their back, then they will somehow get over their prejudice against guns and start to realize that this is what the framers intended. And they really do feel that what they're doing is helping create a shift in the culture so that we can have a more informed and they would say meaningful conversation about guns instead of reacting with the kind of terror that those four women in the restaurant felt.
Is there a case to be made that the attempt to intimidate is implicit because the principal audiences for their demonstrations are gun control groups?
It cuts both ways. In one sense, you can say, you know, they targeted these women. They got on their Facebook page and pretended to be interested in going to this meeting. So clearly, this was not a neutral act. They were coming to intimidate. The other way I would think about it, if I were defending Open Carry Texas, is no, this is clearly speech, right? This is a counter demonstration. This is speakers reacting to other speakers. What more pure form of speech is this?
Not intimidation, education.
Exactly. This is their target audience. And who better to talk to than people who are proposing gun control measures?
I'm not a free speech absolutist, but there is a limited number of circumstances that I see as exceptions. One is the famous shouting fire in a crowded theater scenario. We as a country have witnessed horrendous violence at the hand of assault weapon-wielding criminals, with dead children. Scarcely a week goes by where there is not another incident of murder by assault weapon. Is the nation not already the crowded theater to which Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes referred?
There are reasons to say, look, we regulate all kinds of speech. We have all kinds of time, place, and manner regulations about speech. This is one of those areas in which there are so many nuanced readings of a person carrying an AK-47. One reading is, I am expressing my Second Amendment right that I may carry a gun and that I like to carry a gun. And by the way, I think you should carry a gun too. But there's another reading, oh my God, that person can kill me. What I think Open Carry Texas would say is it is perfectly clear that second reading isn't accurate. I'm not here to kill you. I'm here to make a statement about guns. But I think as a general matter, the problem with these open carry protests is it is not an unreasonable reading to see somebody with a weapon and say, my first and only reaction is this person could kill me.
All right, Dahlia. As always, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dahlia Lithwick is a writer for Slate with University of Georgia law professor Christian Turner. She co-wrote the piece, It's Not My Gun, It's Free Speech. We've become accustomed in the past 20 years to seeing the issue of guns in America broken down into two camps. Gun control advocates, led by police chiefs and Sarah Brady, against the all-powerful National Rifle Association, which not only asserts a Second Amendment guarantee of gun ownership, but uses its vast war chest to elect sympathetic politicians and to defeat opponents. But according to Adam Winkler, UCLA law professor and author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, there was a time, relatively recently in fact, when the NRA supported gun control legislation, and the staunchest defenders of so-called gun rights were on the radical left. That piece was excerpted in The Atlantic. When I spoke to Winkler last winter, I confessed that I was genuinely stunned to learn that the origins of the gun rights movement were formed in Oakland, California, in the 1960s.
One of the surprising things I discovered in writing Gunfight was that when the Black Panthers started carrying their guns around in Oakland, California in the late 1960s, it inspired a new wave of gun control laws. It was these laws that ironically sparked a backlash among rural white conservatives who were concerned that government was coming to get their guns next. The NRA mimicked many of the policy positions of the Black Panthers, who viewed guns not just as a matter of protection for the home, but something you should be able to have out on the street, and also protection against a hostile government that was tyrannical and disrespectful of people's rights.
There was an incident with a traffic stop. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale were sitting in a car, lightly armed.
They refused to give up their firearms. The police officer says, what are you doing with those firearms? But Huey Newton had gone to law school for a short time and had learned that in California it was lawful for him to be carrying loaded weapons as long as he carried them openly. In fact, the most dramatic incident was when the Black Panthers, 30 of them, showed up at the California State Capitol armed with loaded rifles, pistols, and shotgun and marched right into the legislative chamber while it was in session. In fact, they were debating a gun control law, and the Panthers were there not to do violence, but to protest this gun control law.
This episode freaked out conservative politicians, including the governor of California, who could not for the life of him imagine a situation where a lawful American would want to carry a loaded weapon in public. What was the name of that governor?
That was Ronald Reagan, who would go on to become the first presidential candidate ever endorsed by the NRA. And of course, his politics did shift. He was an astute political strategist, and he understood by 1980 that he needed to support gun rights to keep his new right coalition together. And he was such an opponent of gun control when he was in office that even after he was the victim of an assassination attempt, he pushed for no new restrictive gun laws.
So tell me more about the origins of the National Rifle Association, and when did they become radicalized along Second Amendment lines?
The NRA was formed right after the Civil War by two former Union soldiers who were convinced that it was the poor marksmanship of Union soldiers that had allowed the war to go on so long. In the 1920s and 1930s, the NRA was a supporter of gun control, pushing states to adopt restrictive laws on concealed carry of firearms. In the 1960s and 70s, a series of assassinations like Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy and the race riots and the Black Panthers all led to a new wave of gun control laws. The NRA became divided between those who thought guns were primarily about hunting and recreation and those who thought guns were about personal protection against criminals in urban environments. Those hardliners ended up staging a coup at the annual membership meeting one year and replaced the entire leadership of the NRA with a group of hardliners who were committed to fighting gun control at all costs.
This was a schism that occurred at a point when the existing leadership of the NRA really wanted to move out west and focus on hunting.
That's right. I think of how different politics in America would be had the leaders of the NRA in the early 1970s carried through with their plan to retreat from political activity, move to Colorado Springs, and focus the organization on outdoors activities. That didn't happen, of course, and the NRA became committed to a very extreme view of the Second Amendment that really fought against any new gun control proposals under the theory that any new law was a slippery slope towards total civilian disarmament. And that view has really shaped gun rights in America ever since.
The NRA broke a 4-day silence since the shootings to say that it wants to make a contribution in the ongoing debate and presumably to work with the president in helping fashion gun control for the foreseeable future. What do you suppose that means?
The NRA is very firmly committed to its view of the Second Amendment, and this incident is not going to change its view. We're going to see the NRA probably emphasize the need to have better mental health information or mental health treatment. We're likely to see the NRA talk about perhaps even arming teachers in schools as the answer, because the view of the gun rights extremists is that more guns will lead to less crime and that the way to respond to mass shootings is by having more people with guns to be able to fight back. I don't expect that to change.
Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Winkler is a professor of law at UCLA and author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Coming up, John F. Kennedy famously enthralled the press. Recordings unearthed for a public radio documentary also show how Kennedy sucked up to the press and how he bullied them. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. It's that time of year again. Leaves cover the ground with their autumn palette. Foodstuffs get flavored with pumpkin spice. And John F. Kennedy shows up on the newsstand. Magazine covers, cable documentaries, books. As November 22nd approaches each fall, so does the annual resurrection of Camelot. Now comes the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination, and with it, total immersion in all things JFK. Unanswered questions about his murder, revisiting of the Bay of Pigs and the missile crisis, and the women, mercy, the women. To Nick Gillespie, editor of the libertarian Reason.com, it's all almost more than he can bear. Not for what it says about our martyred president, but for what it says about a media culture he believes to obsessively pander to the baby boom generation. Nick, welcome back to On the Media.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
You have a name for this phenomenon. You call it repetition compulsion disorder?
Yeah, and I think that's a fair and accurate diagnosis of what's going on here, particularly to the baby boom generation. JFK remains the kind of athlete dying young because he never actually had to deliver on very much in terms of his political promise. You know, you can go back and project onto Kennedy not just the glamour of the years when he was in the White House and his ascent through the Senate, but what would have been. The 60s and the 70s were tough decades in many ways. And so you can go back to Kennedy and say everything would have been aces if he had only lived. He is a kind of perfect Rorschach blot that people can project what they want onto.
These all sound like legitimate lines of journalistic inquiry. What's your beef?
I think my beef is that people rarely check their premises on a lot of these things. During the 60s itself, JFK was not a hero necessarily. He was seen as part of the old guard. He was in many ways a conventional Cold War hawk. But then he is transformed by people like Oliver Stone in the movie JFK into somebody who would have immediately declared peace and honor in Vietnam and gotten us out. Or he didn't really believe in the Bay of Pigs, which went disastrously wrong. Or he was going to really do great things on race relations, which by all historical accounts, he dragged his feet on tremendously. The flip side of this is that JFK is also kind of the mirror for all of the dark forces in America. His father was a bootlegger, which is actually not true. He came to power through all sorts of horrible machinations. He was particularly hideously awful towards women. So JFK kind of hovers over the journalistic elite as this guardian angel or this demonic force by which we're supposed to make sense of the current day.
Now, your piece, which ran in the Daily Beast, centers on the preoccupation with John F. Kennedy. But if I understood it correctly, your actual gripe is not with JFK obsession per se, but with the baby boom generation as a whole, which you find to be just loathsomely arrogant and self-absorbed. You describe the baby boom as having cultural hegemony over, among other things, the entire journalistic universe.
Yeah. The baby boom, at least since it started appearing on Life magazine covers in the 60s, has been taught that nothing has been so great in the world's history. When Steven Spielberg was promoting Saving Private Ryan back in the late 90s, he actually talked about the most important thing about World War II was the question of whether or not the baby boom was going to be born. And it struck me then, and it strikes me now, as of a piece with a generational arrogance and kind of narcissism and solipsism, that even World War II, which took place before the baby boom occurred, was really all about the baby boom. The fact of the matter is that the sun does not rise and set on the baby boom. And the way the baby boom uses the JFK experience, both the assassination as well as those shimmering years of Camelot, to kind of constantly try and stay front and center in American life, I find appalling.
Look, at this point, I have to start pushing back a bit.
Sure.
The baby boom is a cohort. It's a definition of demographics. It began with the children born at such and such a date, and it ended with the children born at another date. And that is 100% of what baby boomers have in common. And you seem to be imputing on this vast number of people personality traits, self-absorption, self-involvement, arrogance. Is that not kind of like drawing personality conclusions about all left-handers or all Nebraskans?
You know, there's something to be said about making such large statements. They're always subject to question and kind of deconstruction. But, you know, we impute certain characteristics to the so-called greatest generation, which were born during the 20s, raised during the Depression, and then fought World War II. We talk about the silent generation, people who came of age in the 50s before the 60s and before the baby boomers. We talk about millennials. All of these generalizations are correct in some ways and incorrect in others. I don't think that there is much serious question that people born between 1946 and 1964, which is the general definition of the baby boom, have had a very, very long time on the national stage and always seem ready to extend their run another year or two by asserting that the baby boom generation somehow really does define the American experience.
Nick, I must also ask you this. John F. Kennedy as a president may have been great. He may have been good. He may have been no good. His time in office, as you observed, was brief. However, in those not even 3 years, the world came on the brink of nuclear holocaust. He invaded Cuba and failed at great risk. He captured the imagination of the nation in a way that no president, at least since FDR, had done. He was so super hot in a way that presidents seldom are. And he was president of the United States. And finally, he was assassinated under circumstances that remain somewhat mysterious to this day. All of those seem to me like not only good journalistic fodder, but grounds for enduring interest in the man's life and his presidency.
I think there's a question of degree. So, for instance, this time around, and obviously it's the 50th anniversary, we can expect a particularly high kind of tidal pull of interest. But, you know, there's an ebook that the Washington Post put out about the 36 or 39 hours of Patrick Kennedy, who was born and died when JFK was in the White House. That strikes me as a little bit much. Or, you know, when you talk about his three brief years in office, it seems like we obsess more about the Kennedy years than we do about the Eisenhower years, which were far more consequential in every possible way from a historical angle and in a way that directly affects how America defines itself in the world today. You know, there's a difference between, say, Marlon Brando as an actor and James Dean, you know, and if we cast James Dean as kind of like JFK, it's you can only pick over a small body of work for so long before things start to get ridiculous. And I think we have long past reached the moment of diminishing returns. There comes a time where we have to say, you know what, we're no longer talking about the Spanish-American War. We're not talking about the Spanish Civil War. We have to leave the obsessions of our youth behind and start moving into the future, not in ignorance, but in understanding that the past cannot govern us, or else we will be governed by the past.
Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nick Gillespie is editor of Reason.com. He wrote this piece for the Daily Beast. It was titled, JFK Still Dead, Baby Boomers Still Self-Absorbed. Amid the avalanche of JFK retrospectives is an extraordinary radio documentary titled, We Knew JFK, Unheard Stories from the Kennedy Archives. Producers unearthed a trove of interviews which for the past half century have mainly moldered in the vaults of the JFK Presidential Library and Museum. They consist of recollections from Kennedy contemporaries, advisors, friends, rivals, and journalists, and yield many an insight and many a surprise. We've used the opportunity occasioned by the documentarian's work to ourselves peruse the archive for a better understanding of the young president's relationship with the press. Our guide is the host and co-writer of the radio special, Robert McNeil, of McNeil-Lehrer fame, who 50 years ago was himself riding in the Dallas presidential motorcade as a correspondent for NBC News when the president was shot. Robin, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob.
I want to begin with the famous Kennedy charisma, which seemed to trump inexperience and religious bigotry and even policy in the race for the 1960 Democratic nomination over the obvious frontrunner, Minnesota Senator Hubert Humphrey. Humphrey was a party leader and a liberal firebrand, but not exactly anybody's idea of a sex symbol. And the thing is, he knew it. He was a bit bemused and a bit resentful.
I loved Hubert Humphrey. In fact, I covered him a lot more than I covered JFK. All the efforts to describe Kennedy's charisma today probably fall flat because the man himself isn't there. But the man's assurance was so colossal and so all-encompassing that the effect on me must have been like kings were able to do to their subjects. And I could sympathize with Hubert Humphrey and Richard Nixon. Confronted with all that social and sartorial assurance, not even considering all the other Kennedy assets, his own good looks, his wealth, his wit, his sense of irony, everything.
Humphrey, it turns out, just thought it was unfair. Let's listen.
The thing that I always used to be amazed at was the unbelievably good publicity. It was just fantastic. He would always get good copy. For I used to say to you, how in the world does a man do this? I mean, I would be interpreted as being brash or talkative, and he was always interpreted as being intelligent, and delightful, and able, and so on. And I, you know, needless to say, that always bothers a fellow.
Of course, Humphrey was accused of being talkative because he went on and on and on and on. Kennedy had a much better sense of how much to say and when to shut up than Humphrey did.
Robin, the turning point in the general election that year, and some would say the future of presidential politics, is often at least remembered to be the televised debate between JFK and then Vice President Richard Nixon. Now, some mythology has evolved over the decades about the event, but you discovered the testimony of Don Hewitt, who is most remembered for creating and running 60 Minutes on CBS, but who back in 1960 was the producer of the Nixon-Kennedy debate.
He gives a very sharp and well-observed comment on the different approaches of the two men and then how they looked.
Well, here's Don Hewitt on the power, for better or worse, of the TV image.
I said to both of them, would you like some makeup? And Kennedy, who didn't need any, said, no, thank you, no. Nixon, who needed makeup, also said no, because he didn't want history to record that night he was made up and Kennedy wasn't. So they took him back in a room and they made him up with something called a shave stick, and badly. He looked awful. When he came out, I looked at them both on camera. Kennedy looked great. Nixon looked terrible. That's all anybody remembers about that night. That night was a great night for Jack Kennedy and the worst night that ever happened in American politics. That's the night the politicians looked at us and said, that's the only way to campaign. And television looked at them and said, they're a bottomless pit of advertising dollars.
Yeah, and you could certainly carry that a lot farther today.
Now, Hewitt was expressing what is the popular narrative of the JFK-Nixon debate, but the contemporaneous polling did not show any sort of Kennedy drubbing of Nixon, and yet what Hewitt said is conventional wisdom. What was your take?
The other conventional wisdom was that people who only heard it on the radio thought that Nixon had won on points. Barry Goldwater, who expected to run against Kennedy in 64, he first heard it on the radio, thought Nixon had won, and then he went to an event where they showed it on the screen, and Goldwater was convinced immediately that Nixon had had it that evening.
I want to ask you about some more nitty-gritty press handling. A couple of the journalistic luminaries in your documentary give us a glimpse of Kennedy's off-the-record demeanor with the press, sometimes as a flatterer, sometimes as a bully. CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite gives us a window into Senator Kennedy's arrogance and presumptuousness in manipulating the process of a pair of one-on-one interviews that he was giving the candidates.
The situation was that Walter Cronkite of CBS had done an interview with Kennedy, and Kennedy didn't like the interview. And he said, we'll do it again. He just assumed. And Cronkite protested. Kennedy insisted. And Cronkite continued to protest, and eventually Kennedy gave in and said, play it as it is.
And I started out, and I got almost to the door, and I turned and I said, let me tell you, Senator, we're going to do this. But I think this is the lousiest bit of sportsmanship I've ever seen in my life. And turned, walked out the door. Before I got to the door, he said, wait a minute. Go ahead and use it. The one thing with a Kennedy, you can't accuse him of bad sportsmanship. That hit him. I didn't know how powerful that little speech of mine would be. I hadn't intended it to work. I was just mad, angry.
Bob, I know another story where Kennedy insisted on redoing something, and this time Jackie refused. It was during Charles Collingwood's tour of the White House with Jackie for CBS. At one point in the tour, a door opens and the president steps in as though informally and by accident, and they have a little crosstalk, and then he leaves. And when the taping ended, Kennedy said, I want to see the tape. And they went out to the CBS truck, and he saw the tape again. He said, I don't like it. I want to do that part again. And Jackie said, no, I've got a writing date in Virginia. The president said, we're going to do it again. And Jackie said, no, I'm going riding in Virginia. And she went, and the CBS producer had to sit in for the retake.
She didn't object on ethical grounds. She objected on equestrian grounds.
Right.
Now, the same son of entitlement who was dictating coverage to TV producers one second could be flattering reporters the next. Tom Wicker, the longtime New York Times columnist who at the time was a young reporter covering the White House for the Times, he had written a piece that was critical of the president's oratorical skills.
I stated the thesis in there that he was a pretty good speaker extemporaneously, but that he read speeches very badly. I was shown into his office. It was late in the day, as I recall it. And first thing he said to me after we shook hands, he said, you know, he says, you're right. He says, I can't read a speech worth a shit. This was practically the first words he had said to me. And I later recounted this story to my wife, and she was shocked to her teeth. She said, you mean the President of the United States said that?
Ingratiation by self-deprecation?
Kennedy had a great talent and a huge, vicious vocabulary when he was annoyed. One time in August of 63 at Hyannis, I was playing tennis with Pierre Salinger on the grounds of the family compound there, and the phone kept ringing, interrupting the game, and Salinger had to go and talk to it and then come back and resume the game, and finally we just gave it up. The president was absolutely furious at the New York Times, which he'd been reading that Sunday, for the reporting on Vietnam.
And when the president was angry, charisma or no charisma, he was not above retaliation, or at least the threat of retaliation.
Yeah, yeah.
Tom Wicker experienced that himself.
Yeah.
Times wrote a rather critical editorial, and the tone of the criticism was not that the president was wrong in his proposals, but that he hadn't gone far enough. They were saying you should move farther, and you should do this, and you should do that, and it was quite a critical editorial. So I went in on some routine mission to talk to Ted Sorensen that morning. He was reading the Times editorial when I came into the office. He said to me, if this is the attitude that the New York Times is going to take, then our relationships with you, meaning me personally, can get very sour. And I took this to be a threat at the time that if the Times is going to be critical editorially, then the staff and so forth were not going to be very generous in giving news to me. And I took that rather seriously because at that time I knew that some of the reporters had been penalized in this way.
It's interesting hearing Wicker's voice there, because he opens our documentary. You just hear him calling the dictation desk at the New York Times from Dallas. And he says, Dallas, November 22nd. And he begins in that flat voice, very professionally dictating the lead story in the Times for the next day. It's so moving.
You know, Robin, your story about playing tennis with the president's press secretary, Pierre Salinger, reminds me that on this show over the years, we've often looked askance at the excessive chumminess between the press and official Washington. But one of the things revealed in the tapes is the remarkable degree of intimacy that Kennedy had with the very people charged with covering his administration. CBS's Don Hewitt, whom we heard earlier, tells a story about his then wife that is positively jaw-dropping.
And she went to the White House at dinner with the president and Kenny O'Donnell and Pierre and Dave Powers, you know, the guys. And they won't let too much to drink. And they were needling. He said, I have no idea why I did this. He said, I had about as much needling as I could take. And I stood up at the table. I looked at the president of the United States. And I said, you can take your White House and shove it. And he said, will you just sit down and finish your dinner? No, I'm getting it. She grabbed her coat and she left. She woke up the next morning, hungover, and she said to herself, oh my God, what did I do last night? How many people have a close personal relationship with the President of the United States and blow it? So she said about 5 o'clock, she got up enough nerve to call Evelyn Lincoln. And Evelyn said to her, where are you? She said, what do you mean, where am I? She said, he thinks you're mad at him. She said, thank God. She said, come over here. She went over, it was about 5 o'clock. She was very clever, she had a great line. She went there and she said to him, I'm willing to be forgiven.
Now, elsewhere in this story, Hewitt declares that his then wife was having an affair with President Kennedy.
I didn't know that. That's amazing.
So you were the host of this show, and you were a co-writer and also a witness to the very history that it wishes to flesh out. As you listen to these anecdotes, do you find yourself in retro thrall of the president, or do you find yourself as a journalist kind of cringing?
I think on the whole, the anecdotes reinforce the grounds I had for admiring Kennedy. I came to Washington in the spring of 63, and my ears had been stuffed with all the stale rhetoric of the Cold War up to then, and it was enormously refreshing to hear a man redefining that rhetoric, to hear him schooling Americans not to assume that war was inevitable and peace impossible or the Cold War was permanent. It was liberating to my spirit to hear that. By the end of his presidency, I think a lot of people abroad felt that way too, that they had, as a leader of the leading country of the West, a man who justified faith in rationalism And when so many people had feared American trigger happiness, they were reassured by that. I think that is one of the reasons why Kennedy's death not only pierced the membrane of individual self-protectiveness of people in this country of all ages, but all around the world.
Robin, thank you so much.
It was a real pleasure, Bob.
Robert McNeil is the narrator and co-writer of We Knew JFK, Unheard Stories from the Kennedy Archives. It's airing on many public radio stations around the country and can also be heard online along with other voices from the archive at weknewjfk.org. The program was produced and distributed in association with PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, and funded by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
I am today announcing my candidacy for the presidency of the United States. The presidency is the most powerful office in the free world. Through its leadership can come a more vital life for all of our people.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Durkman, Chris Neary, and Laura Mayer. We had more help from Zach Spencer and Megan Tian. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Dunn and Ken Feldman. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.